Native Circles, a podcast for Indigenous experiences and conversations.
Dedicated to Native American and Indigenous histories from Indigenous voices and lived experiences. We talk each month with historians and intellectuals committed to working with and for Indigenous communities, especially to share Indigenous stories.
Within a circle of respect, trust, and compassion. Welcome to another episode of Native Circles. I'm Sarah Newcomb, Tsimshian of the First Nations, and I'm here with Dr. Farina King.
Yate! Hi, everyone.
Today, we are welcoming our guest, Elena E. Roberts, PhD historian, and we are discussing her book, I've Been Here All the While, Black Freedom on Native Lands. Roberts is a writer, teacher, and public speaker. She is an award-winning historian who studies the intersection of Black and Native American life from Civil War to the modern day. She is currently assistant professor of history at the University of Pittsburgh. Welcome, Elena. We are so happy to have you today.
Thank you for having me.
Hi, Elena. It's good to have you.
Thank you for joining us. In your book, you mention a family member, and I like your introduction and dedication. I immediately started reading that to find out kind of what inspired you. And you mention a family member in your dedication, Travis Roberts, and you mention also feeling led by your ancestors to your work. Would you be willing to share some of what inspired you in your own family history?
Yeah, so I was very much a person who didn't know what I wanted to do with my life. I knew I liked writing, I liked reading, but I definitely saw college as a space where I was supposed to figure that out. And it kind of just came to me in a very fortunate way. And I knew some of my family's history. I knew my father's family was from Oklahoma. I knew that we had a Native heritage and that that was kind of an important part of the lives of the people who lived in Oklahoma. But being in California, I was very much disconnected from that history and identity. And so in college, I was assigned a family tree assignment, and I really dove into that. And I talked to people like Travis, who all along had this kind of trove of information, oral histories that he'd collected from his mother and father, his grandparents. And he was so much closer to our Choctaw and Chickasaw ancestry and history, and learning from him that we had been enslaved by these people, but also that we shared ancestry with these people, and really talking to him and finding out how much it hurt him that he was not able to enroll as a citizen as he was legally supposed to be able to, really kind of gave me this as a mission to write about this, to tell people about it, and to make it a part of my personal identity.
Yeah. Do you mind, you know, even stepping back there, because I think a lot of the general public and our listeners aren't even aware of these very deep intersections, the relationships between diverse Native American peoples and Black Americans. How do you explain that, you know, in a nutshell to someone? It's so complicated, but really important that people understand that basic background.
Yeah. So I think, especially in the African American community, there is an idea that Native Americans and African Americans had kind of alliances, worked together in like the 1700s and 1800s. A lot of people know the story of the Seminoles and their relationship with Black people in Florida. So Black runaways who came and lived kind of separate from the nation, but had a relationship with them. And there certainly are kind of more positive aspects of Black and Native interactions over time in the United States. But there also is a history of slavery. And so there were five Indian nations, the Choctaws, Chickasaws, Creek, Seminoles, and Cherokees, with members who owned Black slaves from the 1700s to 1866. And so my research specifically looks at the way that slavery and emancipation was both similar to that of white Americans and also different.
And how do you explain those similarities and differences? You know, because I see that come up as I'm based now in Oklahoma, Indian Territory, Cherokee Nation, and this is certainly an ongoing pressing issue. I mean, it connects to real broad dynamics as well of public memory in the United States, all the controversies over histories of slavery and ongoing struggles, the drive for anti-racism and facing white supremacy and these groups. But then, you know, most people don't understand as well, as you just shared, Native Americans as slave owners too, who enslaved people, and also Blacks who traveled and were forced on the Trail of Tears as well, these forced removals too. So then, you know, it gets really messy when thinking about these comparisons to different forms of slavery or different experiences of slavery. What do you see as some of these really key similarities and differences when you talk about them?
Well, I think it's important to see what happened in Indian nations historically and today as kind of a parallel to that in the United States. And so just as there were owners in the United States who, you know, were, let's say, less harsh slave owners and also more sadistic slave owners, this was the case in Indian nations. And today, just as the United States took a very long time to be comfortable talking about slavery and representing slavery in museums and cultural centers, the same thing has happened in Indian nations. And so most cultural centers within, especially the Chickasaw and Choctaw nations, you're barely going to see slavery, if at all. You're barely going to see any discussion of the Black people who lived in these nations for over 100 years. And so it's been really kind of a journey to come to terms with this history in both spaces, because it's uncomfortable and it's acknowledging that, you know, some of our ancestors did bad things. And I don't think there's any kind of shame in admitting that. There's more shame, I think, in not talking about it and reflecting on it and trying to change and do better. And so that's something I see as important in both contexts, the United States and in Indian nations. And obviously the Cherokee Nation has recently made big strides in that. I'm very happy to see that. And I'm hoping that something similar will happen in the Choctaw and Chickasaw Nations. But when I say that, I'm specifically referring to the Cherokee Nation removing the Confederate monuments that they previously had in Tahlequah. And the Cherokee chief, Chuck Hoskin Jr., taking a lot of time and effort to acknowledge this history, try to make amends personally as well as nationwide. The Cherokee Supreme Court taking out the terminology that refers to Cherokee nations as only by blood, acknowledging that some freedmen being the former slaves of Cherokees, are Cherokee ancestrally, but also just kind of acknowledging this shared history that is also important in kinship and talking about who is a part of our community.
Thank you. One of the things that you said just rings so true, and that's that regardless of whether the history of each group is positive or negative, that shouldn't be a factor in whether or not we tell the history. It's less respectful not telling the history. Each group is so important in our understanding, in our learning. I've had experiences not knowing any of it. I had no idea the 1921 Tulsa race massacre. I only learned about that a few years ago, and it blew me away that I didn't know about it. High school, college, never hearing about the things that Indigenous people went through, not hearing the things that Black people went through, and being Indigenous myself and not knowing my own history was shocking as I started diving in. So this is something that while I was reading your book, there's just such a tremendous amount of information that I was learning from and gaining from. In what ways did understanding your past history help you in understanding our modern world?
So many ways. And this is what I try to pass on to my students when I teach them that, you know, understanding, I don't know, like the poverty in Black communities and Native communities, the kind of history we learn and why we learn it in a certain way, and the supposed narrative of progress, the United States is only getting better and better. It doesn't really make sense why our country is so diverse, but also so separated, why people are so hesitant to talk about class and race and the divisions that were essentially created, until you know that these things were kind of purposely done by the people who were in power, predominantly rich white men, who created not just kind of class divisions, but also racial divisions, and stopped alliances that were forming between like poor white and black men or poor like black and native people. And so there are so many different times throughout American history that people have tried to come together and look at similarities more than differences. And they've always been kind of stamped out, which is why we see so much division in this country, because, you know, I'm repeating myself, but it's so amazing to me how much makes sense when we know about, for example, like the Tulsa Massacre, that no, it's not in fact that Black people are just like lazy or less stupid, like, or more stupid than people of other races. Like, they really came from nothing and created like Black Wall Street and businesses, and it was all taken from them, leading them back to this kind of status of being disenfranchised, of being kind of economically not in a good position. And so when we think about the history that's been told and what's been taken out of it, it creates a very specific narrative about who is supposedly better and who supposedly deserves to be on top. And so when I teach my students about that and they learn how much they haven't been told, then I think it's really pretty mind-blowing just how education and history itself can change the way you think about your life and your circumstances.
Thank you. Yeah, one of the items that you discuss, I believe it's in your introduction, is your definition of settler colonialism and how it's not a race or ethnicity identification. Could you tell me a little bit more about that and how that applies even to understanding the history you write about and how it also affects modern days? Like, that definition was really kind of changed the way I viewed settler colonialism, and I thought it was really important.
So I think the kind of classic definition of settler colonialism is thinking about white European settlement in usually the Americas, but also Australia, New Zealand, all these different spaces. And we think about the replacement of the indigenous population with these white settlers, which is an important component. But there is also the replacement of culture, which comes with the loss of language, and the looking past kind of the moment of settlement and more into, okay, what does it mean that these white Europeans are interacting with indigenous people, intermarrying with indigenous people, and really kind of disseminating their ideas they're creating about race and racial hierarchy, gender norms. And so I kind of talk about settler colonialism as a process that any person of any race can kind of go through and buy into, essentially, to strategically make their life better. And so I talk about Native people, the five tribes, the five slaveholding tribes I've mentioned, and how when they are forced to move to Indian Territory, modern day Oklahoma, they see it as strategically important to settling into their new home to situate themselves as different and better from the Western Native people already living there. And so they call themselves more civilized because they're more likely to speak English, be educated. And then I look at their former slaves and African Americans from the United States and how they then come in and use these kind of settler buzzwords of civilization to say that, well, no, we should have this land and this is why we are better than these Native people. And then white settlers come in and do the exact same thing. And of course, white settlers are ultimately successful in this process. And so I'm trying to complicate the way we think about how people relate to each other, because I think the kind of key foundational thing that people learn eventually is, okay, you know, maybe white people did all these bad things, okay, but people of color also are relating to each other in ways in which like they're adopting these same problematic and horrible beliefs about racial inferiority, about racial difference. And so that certainly structures the way they interact with other people. And so Black and Native people, they have so much more things in common than different. And yet, when you look at their actions historically and today, you're more likely to see them talking about each other as if they're very different, as if maybe one of them is worse than the other. And the whole kind of point of my book is to say, you know, look at this, like it hasn't done any of us any favors to take on the colonizer's viewpoint. And so why don't we just all kind of see that we've all been basically screwed over and let's come together.
Yeah, that is so powerful from this work, right? Is unpacking and dismantling these really solid dichotomies that often form how people simplify and generalize history and understandings as white and black or native white, rather than seeing that it's also, you know, intertribal, different peoples who identify differently. I mean, you talk about the five tribes, right? They are very different. And within the each tribal nation, there's big differences, right? United Kituwa Band here and the Cherokee Nation of Oklahoma. What is that difference? You know, and how did those differences come together? The Ross Party, the Treaty Party, a blood feud. I mean, people often don't understand. I think that's a big part of the contributions of your work, is we say historians complicate things, but it's not that we're complicating it. It's we're revealing the realities of it, right? And pushing, you know, against the homogenization that I think, you know, is a part of that, those processes of settler colonialism, right? There's reasons, I think, why those dynamics are shaped that way. And as Sarah brought up, you know, what we're learning in school, what we're not learning in school, why it's so controversial when historians were trying to just understand what happened. So thinking about these convergences and relationships between different peoples that you're talking about in your work, I think another really exciting and important contribution of your book, and I've read your articles as well and had the opportunity to talk to you before, is what you're saying about kinship and also homelands and land. What do you think you are adding in your own words about understanding who these people are, but especially their relationships with land and how that's shaping kinship too? Could you talk about that a little here?
In the time period that I think is the core of the book, Reconstruction, when you're looking at Black people, the narrative is usually about political rights. So how did Black people come out of slavery and start pushing to vote, pushing to have citizenship, political representation? And that has been, you know, the kind of core of the important books that have come out on this period. And obviously, I understand why it's very important. These have been really great books. But for especially Black people living in the West and Indian Territory, looking at my own family's narratives and stories, land was actually the most important thing to them. And so specifically, my ancestors who were owned by Chickasaws did not have the opportunity to be tribal citizens. So land for them was kind of the only way that they had the ability to keep that connection to the space, this land that had become so kind of important to their community members, really kind of the space that had been what they lived on and built on after removal. And so the land after the Civil War is really important to understanding the trauma of Indian removal and the fact that both Indian and Native people experience that. So it's so important to them to really create something new in Indian Territory and to build it up as something that then, you know, they don't want to be removed from that. And so in broadening that story, I look at Native people, also African Americans from the South, and white people who see Indian Territory land as an opportunity for themselves. And so for Black people from the South, it's a place to be free from white violence, a place where they could possibly have kind of an economic foundation. It's similar for poor whites from the South who also have been disenfranchised through the slaveholding class, really having all the power there. And then for Native people holding onto this land that is being taken from them, even though they were supposed to never, ever be able to like give that up. That is in their removal treaties, that they would never have to share that land with white people or anyone. And so these are all kind of reneged upon by the US government. And so it becomes really a battle between these kind of three core groups of people to claim ownership of land. And I feel like this is a narrative that we haven't focused on as much, especially in the post-Civil War period.
Thank you for explaining that more, because I feel that it's often, unfortunately, like walking on eggshells talking about these dynamics. I mean, I've listened to even Cherokee council meetings where there's not a full consensus of people understanding these histories, understanding, you know, even relating to Sarah's question and your response to it before, our world today and why things are. I think that's a big part of where people have just embraced and hold so tightly on to some of these forms of racism, or, you know, just even seeing the world as a contest, a competition, us versus them. And it's very divisive, you know, in society and throughout the world, right? So I think this work is really important for us to come to empathize, to understand, and move forward, you know, that we don't have to continue certain traditions, certain mindsets, and it's so important to change. So my last question for you is, how do you articulate, or what do you recommend to not only tribal leaders and those who are seen as the decision makers, you know, on those large scales, like Principal Chief Hoskins, who he decided, you know, he removed that statue of Stan Waite, who was a Cherokee, you know, Confederate general who was very vocal about being pro-slavery, right? He removed that. And I heard that he said, some of these things you don't need to have a conversation about. He just did it. You know, he made that kind of executive decision. He said, when it's right, you know, do it. I'm paraphrasing, you know, that's not exactly what he said, to not misquote him, but that was the sense of it, right? But not only if we're talking to tribal leaders, but so important, I think, grassroots for all peoples to understand these important messages you've been sharing with us today, these histories of what's been happening and how we understand it. So how do you word that, you know, on speaking at those kind of multiple levels? It's really hard, but, and sorry to put you on the spot with that, but, you know, I'm sure you've been thinking about this a lot, of people asking, now what, you know, now what do we need to do? And maybe, and I'm sure that message, the way you articulate that, will change depending on who you're talking to, but is there a common thread with the kind of recommendations you have, insights you have, what you envision for the future?
In short, I think the common thread for any audience I'm speaking to is be open to listening. Don't be defensive. Hear other people's perspectives. You don't necessarily have to agree with all of it, but, you know, we all have different kinds of things that we're bringing to the new knowledge that we take on. And, you know, it's not easy. I mean, this wasn't like an easy book to write. And I know it's not necessarily the most kind of hopeful book. It's kind of sad at times. And our history is sad, but we would better understand it, and we can better move forward if we listen to one another, take from that what we can, and try to see commonalities moving forward.
Thank you, Elena. I've been so inspired by your wisdom and the heart that you put into the book. And it's so important, like you said, for people to be open and be able to listen and understand. And something Farina said was to empathize. Why I'm passionate about history and reading and learning history is it helps me empathize and learn what people went through. It changes my worldview and makes, at least for me, makes me react differently in different situations in modern times, being able to understand that past history. So thank you so much for your work and for putting so much into it. We're definitely going to link your book in the podcast. Are there any other resources that you think would be important for listeners to have access to learn more about the history?
If you don't have time to read the book, I have a Time magazine piece I've written that talks a little about my family, that connection, and then kind of the history, the core of the book. So I'd recommend that. And then also BuzzFeed has an article on Seminole Freedmen being denied healthcare at their Indian health clinic in the nation. And I think that is a really good resource to learn that this is still very much affecting people, and the prejudice that some Native people have against Black people can literally be a life and death situation.
Thank you for sharing such important resources and reminding us, especially with this ongoing pandemic of COVID-19 and how it has disproportionately affected Black, Indigenous people of color. How can we really support each other? And I think what Sarah just said, all the insights you've shared with us today, Elena, and through, yes, your excellent works. I also express gratitude for that. And I think what's really hit me and come to mind is this work and these conversations help us to recognize family, you know, help us to see the humanity in each other. And a lot of these processes, slavery, dispossession, removal, all those dark, sad histories that you were talking about, those happen because of dehumanization, where other people could dehumanize in their mind another person and not see their relation with them, not respect that. And so that's what really comes to mind from this. And I think it's great that Sarah started off with sharing how your family history and the themes of kinship resonated, you know, and sharing that, because that's a powerful work too, is balancing, you know, your own personal connection to this history, but also showing how it matters for anyone and wherever they're coming from, whether they have this connection to Oklahoma, Indian Territory, Native peoples, Black, you know, whatever. I think that's what really arises for me. And thank you for that. Yeah, Wado. And I know there is a lot more we all can do, especially where I am, wherever anyone is, you know, more we can do in that regard. Thank you. Do you have any words you want to close with,
Elena? I think your questions have been great. So just thank you, audience, for listening.
Thank you.
Thank you.